Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Lingita One Talk. Aloha kako and kia rana. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoll, and it's a privilege to bring our show to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. On the show today, there's a threat of plant diseases and theft that could affect the price of gava in Fiji. We tala noa about the 150th Constitution of Tonga and its relevance today. And also, questions remain unanswered around MMT player Elias Agato's participation in the recent Kiwis versus Tonga game. All that and more here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, the price of gava is booming in Fiji, but growers are struggling to capitalise amidst threats from plant diseases and theft. It's seen some farmers turn to other crops like copra, prompting the Ministry of Agriculture to step in and find a solution. Lucy Cooper reports.
Global demand for kava is growing, and with it, the price. Simone Loma Loma reckons the type of kava grown has also changed.
Farmers still bring kava and sell it in the markets, but majority of the kava has shifted from dried kava to green kava. And the reason they would historically have done dried kava is because the farmer gets a better price when they're doing dried kava. It requires more work. You know, it's dependent on the weather. Whereas for a farmer, if you can sell it green, you get money quickly, and then you can just focus on farming the kava and not have to worry about the processing side of it.
He co-owns Wakanavu, a Fijian kava farming and exporting business.
The middlemen are willing to come out and buy kava green and then do extra work in terms of washing and cleaning and cutting and drying it, which the farmers all used to normally do because of the shortage of kava. And if they didn't do it, then they're not getting the kava. So it's one way for them to secure their supply of kava, and farmers are getting more money in their pocket, essentially, which is good.
But Simone is finding it hard to ride the price high. He says kava dieback disease and nematodes in the soil have impacted about 50 to 60% of his crop.
It is a big issue, but at the same time, it's one of those things that it's hard to manage at the time. It's all, you know, from a cash flow and labour perspective. You know, in hindsight, looking back, it'd be, oh, great, if we had managed to keep on top of those things. I guess the only other way would really be to plant less kava and focus on maintaining the plants that you have planted.
First discovered in Fiji in 1935, kava dieback disease is a virus that is caused by the cucumber mosaic virus, or CMV. It's spread from plant to plant, primarily by aphids.
The disease is called dieback because it starts from the leaf, and then it travels down to the stem, and then it goes right to the root.
That's Taloi Vasundraketti, a senior researcher in plant pathology at Fiji's Ministry of Agriculture. Since last year, farmers and exporters have been increasingly contacting the ministry about kava crop losses and impacts. They said kava dieback was the culprit, so the ministry went out to investigate.
We have conducted a national survey on kava dieback. There were a total of about 13 farmers or 13 households that planted kava plants. And out of the 13 farmers, about 10% are impacted with kava dieback disease.
Mr. Vasundraketti said researchers were able to verify in the field that there were other factors contributing to the crop's woes. One of the main culprits were root knot nematodes, minute worm-like animals that infect the roots, resulting in the kava plant to be wilted or stunted. So to help farmers, the ministry embarked on nationwide awareness about what's impacting kava crops, including nematodes, weather and dieback. They're also researching kava varieties that are immune to dieback disease.
Dieback is not easy to manage or to control because it's a virus. we have tried options here in Fiji, and we found that, yes, it's not easy to control the virus. Yeah? There are a number of the management practices that are in place. And one of the main ones is, to start off with a clean plant material. Eh? The next second thing, plant it with other crops. Eh? This disease is spread by the vector aphids. Eh? And if you do monocropping, it's easier for the aphid just to come land on the cover and then you have the disease. With intercropping, there are a number of crops planted with cover. So in a way, they act as a barrier to stop aphids actually landing on cover crops. Eh? The other one is the barrier cropping, that is planting other plants as a border to the cover plants, to the cover plantation. The point is just to stop the virus. But if you fly in with the virus, they will land first on these plants that looking healthy and green, and then they will lose the virus.
Mr. Vasoon Draketi is hopeful this will work.
It's also a positive outlook that we can fight against cover dieback disease and assure the farmers they don't have to be fear of cover dieback disease, but there's always a solution to every problem that we have.
Back on the farm, Simone Lomaloma said dieback and nematodes aren't his only issue.
Theft has become a big issue for a lot of farmers and also for ourselves as well. I've been out of the country for a month, and I go back in about 10 days, and within 24 hours of me flying out, we had our first instance of theft from me leaving. And then the same group, it was a group of five boys, they came back within 6 days, and one of them was actually caught, and they stole about $25,000 worth of cover just within two evenings.
He's calling for change.
Some people criticise the police, but it's just so widespread. A lot of it goes unreported, but I think the true problem actually is with the courts, the justice system. So you just essentially get a slap on the wrist. You might get a fine. They don't take the agricultural theft seriously. And Fiji is a hugely religious country, so it seems quite backwards with how widespread the stealing is. What ends up happening with that is it disincentivizes farmers, because kava has the ability for generational wealth, and all it really comes down to is hard work. So for a lot of farmers, you know, they get to the end of this time and they're harvesting, and then these cultural commitments and theft, you'd be questioning, why do you do all this hard work?
And that's kava grower and exporter Simone Lomaloma, ending that report from Lucy Cooper. Well, there's long been concern over the population of tuna stocks in the Pacific region and the threat posed by overfishing. However, Bill Holden, Global Head of Tuna of the Marine Stewardship Council, a regional NGO dedicated to preserving marine resources, is optimistic that fishery agreements and monitor technology would be sufficient. Melissa Macon spoke with Bill Holden.
There's already a lot of coordinated efforts to assist the Pacific Islanders, and I think just ensuring that coordination goes up to the United Nations level, you know, every level that's necessary, decisions are being made. I think both Australia and New Zealand can really take leadership, but also listen to what the Pacific Islanders are saying. And that's one way of having the whole neighborhood work together to ensure that everybody gets a fair deal.
So I'm thinking about those exclusive economic zones, and they are so vast and take up such a huge proportion of just the globe, really. It's so hard to police that area, and so easy for people with different interests to kind of come in and take what they want sometimes. So what does that surveillance and monitoring support look like?
Yeah, so we're fortunate that technology is improving, but historically, Australia and New Zealand have really assisted the Pacific Islands to survey for the surveillance in their EEZs. But I would say that now there is, with the improved technology and satellite technology and the beacons that all vessels are carrying to locator positions, and this is available on platforms now, and this allows us to see where vessels are fishing and when they're meeting up at sea. Of course, people can go silent or go black. And so you always need that the satellite technology and also the the surveillance that's done by Australia and New Zealand with their Air Force and some of their vessels. I know Australia's had vessel programs in various Pacific islands and assisted them with monitoring what's happening in their EEZ.
Would you find that different parts of the world are more hostile than the Pacific in the way that we work in this regionalism approach? You have forums and members are all really wanting to support each other's interests as a whole, but when these tuna stock get elsewhere in the world, it's really kind of anyone's game.
I mean, the whole region is really the EEZs of the Pacific Island countries. But if you look in the Eastern Pacific, all you have is high seas. And the same with the Atlantic Ocean, you have it's vast high seas, and in the Indian Ocean, a lot of high seas as well. Agreements by governments in the high seas are much more complicated. But with the history of what we've done here in the Pacific and the way that they've been able to manage their EEZs thus far, that context will suit us well for managing this region in the future. And like I said, I'm very positive about the tuna stocks, and I'm positive about the management. It's not going to be easy, but compared to, say, ocean regions where the bulk of the fishing is done in high seas, I think we have an easier task.
And that was Bill Holden, Global Head of Tuna at Marine Stewardship Council, speaking to Melissa Macon. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to sport now, where the NRL and the Rugby League Players Association are looking into the handling of Elias Agathor's head knocks after the Melbourne forward suffered seizures and brain bleeding while playing for Tonga in the Pacific Championships, which saw the Kiwis beat Tonga 40-14. Agathor was allowed to play despite copping a heavy knock from a teammate in the warm-up and another two high hits in the first half of the game. Agathor is now in a stable condition after undergoing surgery, but questions remain unanswered as to whether he was actually fit to play. On the line to discuss this more is host of Neat and Footy and That Pacific Sports Show, Sam Wykes. With that, I say malo, Sam. Thanks for joining us on Pacific Beat. Fefe.
Hey, Fair. It's great to be back on again, Ags. How are you?
I am good. Thank you so much for your time, Sam. I really appreciate it. I just want to get straight into it. I'm wondering, did you actually see the footage of the pre-game hit on Agathor? I mean, what was your reaction to that?
Look, I probably like everyone else, seen it on socials first. Like it was definitely a sickening blow to the head. Like two players colliding like that, and he didn't look like he was in good shape, but it's something that you never want to see, and especially like as accidental as that would have been with Liho right there in the warm up, and I'm so thankful that he's in a stable condition now and he'll be on the mend. But it was a tough watch to see that happen.
Mm. Well, Sam, look, I know both of us, you know, we're not medical professionals, but I know that you come from that world similar to rugby league. Do you think, though, that he should have gone back on the field considering what had happened?
Look, in the warm-up, the one thing that probably people need to understand that the warm-up's different to the game of seeing exactly what would have happened, because when you go out for a warm-up for a game, it's like individual warm-up. There's like little group warm-ups. There's group chat somewhere. There's medical staff probably still strapping players in the room. Coaches would have been having individual chats somewhere. So I believe that some people wouldn't have even seen the severity of that hit, but we would have because we got that broadcast footage, and not everyone gets to see that footage, especially as players. But in the game, when a contact like that to the head happens in the game, everyone will see it in real time, and there's independent doctors looking at it as well, looking out for head collisions like that. So I know there was a trainer that went and saw Ellie, but I haven't seen any other footage. I probably might be wrong here, but I haven't seen any other footage where he was standing, whether he was there watching those high ball catches or whatever they're doing with Lehigh and Ellie. And he could have passed the medical test there for that one. Mm. But the question is, you know, when he has the second one, everyone would have known by then from the first one in the warm-up, but then having the second one during the game, like that's where a lot of questions needed to be asked and why was he allowed back on, regardless if he might have passed it or not, that second concussion test. But he shouldn't have gone back on the second time around. No way. He should have gone back onto that field.
Well, I mean, yeah, thinking about it, I think there was three knocks in the space of 2 hours. I then think, from previous experience yourself, have you actually experienced head knocks and whatnot? I mean, what was the protocols when you were playing?
Yeah, so I've experienced like a similar, not similar to that, sorry. I had two in the one game. And the first one, I passed the concussion test. So when you get taken off, there was a series of questions that you get asked, like a balance test. And they're just looking out for symptoms as well. Like, are you dizzy? Are you feeling tired? Do you know where you are? And then you repeat like apple, orange. They give you 5 words or something like that. And you just got to remember those 5 words. Once you pass that, you can come back on. The second time, I was no good and just came off and just said that was me. But for the concussion test, I know it's a lot stricter now. So we're talking about, 6-7 years ago when that happened. It's a lot stricter now for players. And it's come a long way and it's still got a long way to go. Because for all the good things and all the stuff that's been happening around the head contact rules, that incident right there, 3 times, is definitely not good enough. And it'll be, there's all eyes on what's going to happen, the outcome from this game, on what happens to the people that made those decisions for him to come back onto the field, and especially him having bleeding of the brain and going into surgery. Man, there's going to be a lot of eyes on this to see what the outcome is going to be from this.
Yeah. Well, before I want to actually get into that question, I was just wondering, though, with yourself, though, Sam, did you feel like you could actually play on after, you failed the test or whatnot when you got a head knock?
Yeah, I'll be lying. As a player, man, you're trying to do anything to get back out on that field. And that's why it's so important for independent doctors and the doctors to take that decision out of your head. Because as much as you'll say that, you don't need to prove anything, or it's like you're trying to be tough and think, you just feel like in that moment, I'm there to do my job. And that's do everything for my team, for my teammates, for my club, to give everything and play the best I can. So 100% there's times where, even before the concussion protocols came in, you would 100% lie and say, no, I'm good. I'm good to go. Are you sure? Yeah, leave me alone. I'm good to go. Knowing full well that you weren't good to go.
Which is why I want to actually ask, because, Sam, players just want to play, right? I mean, for this game itself, I don't know, call it pride for country, whether it was about this game being a bit of a do or die to make finals. But I'm sure many people are asking, but at what cost? Because, what message is this sending, especially around player welfare?
Yeah, I've got no doubt. And our Pacific Island men, you know them very well, Ags. You know full well that, there's an element inside where you probably never take that out of them, where they were just going to keep showing up and want to be physical, especially in that sport, and do everything they can for their country. And it's not trying to prove anything wrong, prove to anyone, that's just the nature of how you're built, especially when you play a sport as brutal as rugby league, when you're a boxer or UFC fighter or rugby union, you're trained in a certain way and conditioning yourself in a certain way that, it's no effect. And in the moment, you're going, yeah, of course I'm good to go. I'll do this for sure. I'm here to do my job and I'm going to do it well no matter what. But that's why it's important for the professionals, the doctors out there. That's why they brought all these protocols in, to take that decision out of a player's hand, because there is more to life than just playing footy.
Well, Sam, look, as we sort of wrap up, I just want to know, what lessons do you think we can take away from this? Because I know this could really affect the longevity, right, of Gatua's career. And also, do you think some heads will roll for this because of what happened?
The sad thing is, I believe there will be heads that roll. And the people that will be responsible for the decisions of Elikata returning to the field, they would have made so many good decisions. They would have made 100, thousands of good decisions and good people. But unfortunately for this one decision that's happened right now, there's going to be, I believe there will be some consequences that will come off the back of it, because that can't happen again.
Yeah.
We cannot see a player return like that and go through what he has gone through and say there's going to be nothing done about it. In union, they are very strict with their head contact rules, especially with their head eye tackles. At club level, they want to make the tackle height, almost around the legs, but now it's at below nipple height. So, like, up above the nipple, like, that's a penalty considered a head height. So there's going to be some, there will definitely be some consequences from it. I'm just thankful for the fact that Ellie's in a stable condition. And I just hope, moving forward, that we just never see it again.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like you say, never want to see that type of situation happen again for any of our players. But look, Sam, appreciate your time coming on. Thank you so much for joining us here on Pacific Beat.
No worries. Malo apito. Take care.
No worries. That is Sam Wykes, host of Nisian Footy and That Pacific Sports Show, here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, this week, the Kingdom of Tonga marked 150 years since the signing of its constitution, which is the oldest in the Pacific. In the capital, Nuku'alofa, there have been a number of events marking the occasion. Villagers from the country's east performed ancient songs for King Te Bol VI, known as Whakatakatofa, or traditional morning entertainment. His Majesty led a groundbreaking ceremony for the new Legislative Assembly building, also described as a symbol of Tonga's independence and the endurance of its democracy. And at the Royal Tomb, Mala e Kula, community leaders laid wreaths to remember Tonga's past leaders who shaped the nation's identity under the 1875 Constitution. Our Tonga reporter, Marin Kupo, was at this week's festivities and spoke to locals about what the Constitution means to them.
Freedom. Peace. Celebration.
Marching.
Being Tongan.
Me.
Pride. Matema Tonga.
I'm feeling grateful that we have a Constitution. Because we should have one. I think every country should have one. And we should follow likewise.
Constitution means is gathering all our population and our people of Tonga in believing in one thing, and that is love, respect, and humility for each other.
One of the unique things about the Kingdom of Tonga, not known to a lot of our people back in Australia, is that in 1853, His Majesty King South Te Paul I visited Australia to the colony of New South Wales. And back in 1875, he, of course, wrote up the Constitution of the Kingdom of Tonga, which is basically based on the blueprint of both the Kingdom of Hawaii's Constitution and the Constitution of the colony of New South Wales. It's a very unique link between New South Wales and Australia and the Kingdom of Tonga.
And that is the sounds of our locals there in the Kingdom of Tonga with Marin Kupo on that report. Meanwhile, in the diaspora, what significance does the Constitution hold and how are our Tongans abroad remembering this day? On the line is Tongan community leader from Aotearoa, New Zealand, Pakilau Manase Lua. That I say, marato mai pongpongini, Pakilau.
Malele, Egi, good to be on your show.
Absolutely. Well, Pakilau, happy Constitution Day. I would love to know, could you at least maybe just tell us the significance of Tonga's Constitution of 1875 and what it actually maybe have represented at that time?
One word, I think, encapsulates for me what the Constitution means, and that's freedom. And that's enshrined in our Constitution. In fact, it's the first part of the very first clause. There are three parts to the Constitution. The first part talks about the Declaration of Rights, and the second part is the form of government, and the third one is around land. But the very first part of it talks about freedom, and to me, that's what the Constitution of Tonga talks about. And that's why I think Tongans are so extra, you know. We go over the top because we celebrate the fact that, one, we were never colonized by any foreign power. Two, we have a constitution that's one of the oldest in the Pacific. In fact, it's probably one of the oldest in the world in terms for a nation state. And so I'm really proud of that. And I think all Tongans around the diaspora hold that sense of pride for a tiny little country to have these great things that we can be proud about.
Yeah. Pakileo, what do you think was King George de Bol the first's sort of vision when he actually established the Constitution?
I think it goes right back to 1839 in a place called Bowono in Lava'u, where King de Bol the first freely gave Tonga to God. It's a process called the Tukufonua. Mm-hmm. So he literally grabbed a handful of soil, threw it up in the air, and he said to God, "This kingdom is yours." And from there, that declaration of his Christian faith helped to also keep Tonga free from being taken over by the other foreign powers, who were largely Christian, mainly European at the time, and they were taking over islands all over the place in the Pacific. So that helped. But also the fact that he promulgated some codes. At the same time, he had the Hapai Code of Laws, and then in the 1860s, he put together the emancipation of slavery, you know, of serfdom in Tonga. And that really helped to, again, set a mark for Tonga in the international stage that it's a civilized country, Christian country, and a country that can look after its own. And then, of course, the culmination of that was the Constitution in 1875, which really set it apart.
Yeah, you're talking about that Tukufonua. I'm sure many Tongans have grown up knowing that story and being part of the Constitution. Do you feel like that really has set Tonga apart from other Pacific nations, especially during that period?
I believe so, because take, for instance, in Europe as an example, the case of the British case, where the king there at the time was pretty much the supreme ruler. He had absolute power. And so the barons and the people of the land fought against the king, hence why they had a Magna Carta, which basically set some laws and rules. I think it's around the 11th century or something like that. And the Magna Carta became their set of rules. But that was won by force. The difference with Tonga and our king was that it was freely given. There was not a war, you know, in terms of when he tukufonua to God. It was done freely by the king, basically offering his own power up to the divinity, to God. Mm-hmm. And so that was a thing that I think Tongans are proud of, that our freedom was given freely. And hence why Tongans go overboard when they give freely of their love. You know, you saw that in the celebrations of our MMT here in Auckland recently, and it coincided with the 150th anniversary of our constitution. So it, you know, almost was a divinely, you know, bestowed that we had the MMT game here at the same time.
Well, I think that leads me to my next question, because, yeah, how do you feel the constitution has shaped Tonga's sense of, you know, national identity, even sovereignty over the years, especially for those of us in the diaspora?
Absolutely, and I think it also stems from what I recall. The King Te Pau the First visited Sydney in 1863, I believe, and in that visit he saw something that really moved him, and that was Indigenous peoples of the land, Aboriginal people, First Nations people of Australia, being landless, homeless on their own land. And that really moved the King, and he did not want that to happen to Tonga, which galvanized him even more to ensure that Tonga was never ever taken over by a foreign power, and that it was secure and protected. And so hence why the Code of Laws, the Emancipation Act, the Constitution, and I must say also that the Constitution borrowed heavily from other constitutions like Tahiti, Hawaii, the New South Wales Constitution, to formulate the wording and to make sure we had a government, a form of structure that the Western powers could recognise. And that's why they pretty much left Tonga to its own devices.
Well, Pakilawa, as we mark, you know, the 150 years, what sort of lessons or values from the Constitution do you think still resonate today? And I ask this particularly for, you know, our younger generation.
It's, I think, the concept of matiaki whanua, and again, it stresses the land bit, you know, and the land is precious for us as Tongans because we have the whanua, which is your afterbirth. When you're born, your umbilical cord is buried, or the placenta is buried in the land. Hence, the word whanua is the same for the womb and for the land. And then when you die, you're put back into the land. And so that concept of land, whanua, is powerful in our culture. And this concept of matiaki whanua, which literally means to die for your land, is the origin and the foundation of the Mate Mā Tonga name. Hence why Tongans go overboard when they hear that MMT, that Mate Mā Tonga. It's that fire, that absolute mana of knowing that your land is there. It's solid. You can always go back. You can always return, and you will never lose it. And that's why we are so proud of our constitution, which enshrines that protection forever.
Always, always. Well, how are you and the Tongan community there in Aotearoa, Pakilawa, celebrating this significant milestone?
Oh, I think you know what we're like here in Auckland, Aggie, and you know the flags were out. We had probably every Chinese shop in Otahu who ran out of red Tongan flags. People were borrowing the Canadian flag, the Swiss flag, any flag that looked red. Samoan flag has lots of red in it. So
I think
we
I saw a KFC flag too.
Exactly, KFC flag. Whatever had red was pretty much taken over by the Tongan community, and it was wonderful to see. You know, there were reporters from staff, other media here who were at the game on Sunday, and they were just blown away at the level and just the way that we celebrate. And we were probably a really good example of good sportsmanship because we cheered just as loudly for the Kiwis as we did for our own team. And in fact, when we sang the national anthem, we sang the New Zealand national anthem just as loud as the Tongan national anthem and didn't boo the haka. You know, so we won a lot of fans from around the world at the way our people celebrate, at the way they did that respectfully, and also honouring the tradition of the tuku whanua, and that God is the centre of our culture.
Beautiful. Pakilawa, look, that's all the time we have for this morning, but I really appreciate sharing that. There's a lot of knowledge that you dropped for us this morning. So again, happy Constitution Day, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you. Ofat. Mahalo.
Mahalo. That is Tongan Community Leader from Aotearoa, New Zealand, Pakilawa Manaselua. And to all Tongans around the world, celebrating our 150th Constitution Day.
Hold the front page!
That's Alofatu, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. We're heading around the region to get the latest headlines, and that's always brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, with our news wrap this morning. In the studio this morning, how are you doing?
I'm well, yes. Big, big week in Tonga. I've just learned with Constitution Week, and you've got your Tongan jumper on to mark it.
Exactly what I thought I'd be doing to just represent the beautiful Kingdom of Tonga. But of course, we're heading around the region because we've got some stories. We start off with Guam. They're actually forming a new National Guard force that can be ready to deploy to US cities. What's this about?
Yeah, that's right, Aggie. So 100 troops from Guam will be off to boot camp to learn how to use batons, body shields, pepper spray and tasers. Ooh. So they can carry out crowd control and respond to civil disturbances in American cities. So, yeah, it sounds pretty interesting. So essentially, for a bit of background, the National Guard they're kind of like a reserves force, you know, similar to the Army Reserve like you'd have in Australia and New Zealand.
Yes.
Most of them work full-time jobs. But they usually get activated to respond to things like disasters and stuff like that. And they can also be activated by the American military to sort of come in and help out the Army, Navy and Air Force when they're needed. But this particular push at the moment is on the back of an executive order from Trump to really beef up that National Guard. He gave that order back in August. So He's ordering all 50 states and territories, including wow. Guam, to develop their own quick reaction force of between 50 and 500 troops, depending on the population of the state. And it's these troops who we've seen largely deployed in recent months. They've gone off to Democrat, or a lot of them, Democrat-run cities to help fight crime, despite the objections of several mayors and governors, might I add.
Yeah.
So basically, Aggie, it's Guam's turn to do their bit, and they've been asked to have their force ready to deploy come April.
Yeah, well, do we know whether or not these troops from Guam will be deployed anyway?
Well, according to local media, no deployment order has been issued yet. However, that's not to say it won't come. We've seen National Guard troops deploy to places like LA, Chicago, Washington, even Memphis in recent months. And look, as we know, there's a lot of cities in the US. So look, I wouldn't be surprised to see them head off somewhere sometime soon.
Yeah, that's a wait and see one on that one. Okay, well, we head to PNG. There's, my goodness, well, I know we've had many a story about the population there. It's actually grown according to the latest census data.
That's right. So PNG's population has now surpassed the 10 million mark, according to the final figures from the 2024 population census, which were released recently. So the study began in June last year and concluded last month. However, it was plagued by a host of administrative and logistical issues. In fact, according to RNZ, a PNG academic said it failed to meet the United Nations benchmark standards for reliability data. So I guess take it with a grain of salt. Nevertheless, the results are in, with the Statistics Office reporting that the final figure of PNG's population is 10,185,363 people. So that's actually a 40% increase on the previous population count in 2011, and it's recorded an annual growth rate of 2.6%. There's a couple of other interesting details that came out of it as well. There's actually 500,000 more males than females in PNG, and the average household was five people as well. And perhaps the most surprisingly, at least for me anyway, is that it was Morobe province which actually recorded the highest population with almost a million people, followed by the Eastern Highlands with 800,000 and not the National Capital District. So, yeah, there you go.
I've been to PNG, and let me tell you, it feels like there is about 10 million people there. So, but a beautiful, beautiful country. Yeah, let's get to some sports. Well, yeah, to some sporting news, it is actually unclear if Junior Bolo will have the lung capacity to lead Samoa to victory against the Kiwis this weekend. I'm wondering, what does that actually mean?
I found this quite a funny story, to be honest, Aggie. So Junior Paolo has told the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday that leading the Samoan Sivatau is actually starting to mess with his health.
Wow.
Most notably, his voice. Now, our audience, well, most of them anyway, need no explanation as to what the Sivatau is, but for the ones that don't know, it's kind of the equivalent of the haka. It's a big ceremonial, performative kind of war cry, if you like, that takes place before every game. And it's become quite famous in Australia, particularly when they faced Tonga in recent years. And obviously, he put so much passion into it. But turns out, Aggie, it takes a bit of a toll. It takes a bit of a toll on the vocal cords. And he said, while it's an honour to lead the tradition, it actually leaves him unable to speak for days after each game. In fact, after their last match against Tonga, he's had to drink copious amounts of lemon and ginger tea with honey just to ensure his throat recovered in time for Sunday's final. So I don't know about you, Aggie. It sounds like a bit of a bad omen, though.
No, don't say that. We need them to win this weekend. But, yeah, so it's going to be exciting. I do feel for him.
Absolutely. Well, he did also say that prior to the Tonga game, he also lost his voice after their opener against New Zealand and could only manage to whisper after the Tongan clash. So, you know, when you're the captain of a football team, you need to be barking orders.
Can you imagine
being
on the field? Yeah, that's right. Having to say, hey, pass the ball, but can't hear you.
Sounds like they need to implement some HIA protocols for voices now.
There we go. Oh, well, look, as always, Carl, appreciate you coming through and sharing those stories from around the region here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
What's your favourite view where you live in the Pacific? Grab your phone or your camera and take a pic of it because Nisha Daily is running a photo competition. We're looking for photos which represent you and your part of the Pacific. anyone can enter. You don't have to be a professional, and there are prizes up for grabs. So get snapping and send us a photo in WhatsApp of your favorite view. It's +61 437 519 385. That's +61 437 519 385. And tune in to Nija Daily weekdays from 7 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia for all the details.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, when it comes to fashion, Australia and the Pacific diaspora are avid consumers of popular brand name clothing. In fact, the average Australian buys 55 items of clothing each year. But what happens to the clothing we stop wearing? Well, according to a powerful new film, much of it ends up in the Solomon Islands, which is buckling under the pressure of Australia's insatiable consumer habits and under-regulated disposal practices. Let's take a listen.
Textile waste is a global crisis. Australians are among the biggest consumers of fast fashion, buying an average of 55 items of clothing and discarding 23 kilograms annually. Some of this clothing is sent to recyclers, then exported, often to places like the Solomon Islands. Most of it is made from polyester or blended synthetic fibres, materials that don't break down easily and contribute to environmental degradation. The Solomon Islands import 88% of their second-hand clothing from Australia, basically getting rid of what we would never wear. Each shop in Honiara receives up to 50 bales of clothing from Australia, either every week or month. And each bale can weigh between 50 to 500 kilograms.
Somewhat ironically, though, the film is called Good Neighbours. It premiered yesterday at the Queensland University of Technology, and Kyle Evans spoke with one of the architects behind the documentary, Tiziana Ferreiro-Georges, an Associate Professor of Fashion and Design at the Faculty of Creative Industries and Social Justice.
The retail of this clothing and the people buying them behaves a little bit like fast fashion. So they arrive, they're sorted, they are hanging in shops, and after 1 or 2 weeks, this clothing, if it's not sold, it actually ends up as waste, as rubbish. It is either thrown into these waste bins or it is burnt. Or it goes into the landfill. It actually ends up in places like the ocean. The landfill currently is near the ocean, near the shore. So not only clothing, but everything in that landfill leaks into the ocean. There is a very, I would say, poignant image in our film of clothing, of textiles trapped in the reef. And if you look at that image, you can immediately imagine at scale what that means with so much waste.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my next question. So, you know, if these items of clothing aren't necessarily being disposed correctly, what impact is that having sort of on the environment? Like, what impact is it having on the local population, I suppose?
The problem is that countries like the Solomon Islands and I imagine all other small countries, they don't have the infrastructure to deal with, for example, waste separation. So separating food, metal, building, materials, textiles, and e-waste and so on. I imagine also Fiji and all the other Pacific Islands will be in the same situation. The environmental problems are many, apart from ending up in the ocean as clothing, as textiles. The majority of clothing that we send as Australians is in polyester or mixed fibres that, apart from cotton or linen or silk, will take a long time to degrade, sometimes 100, 200 years. So we're talking about microplastics and also from clothing, not just from the plastic, and in those landfills. So we see also all these plastic bottles. So it is really confronting.
But one of the things that interested me as well was that, you know, Australians buy about 55 items of clothing each year on average. So you can only assume that many people are disposing just as much. What did your research say about Australia's spending habits when it comes to fashion?
Very good question. This number is going to increase because, unfortunately, consumption is increasing globally, and consumption of polyester, consumption of fast fashion, buying clothes. Australians are one of the nations that consumes the most. Australia does not have good policies that look at curbing consumption. Australians are very fond of cheap fashion. Fast fashion ensures that it is cheap, it is used not very often, and in general, after 1 year, it is discarded. So if it is not sold in our charities' shops, then it is given to recyclers and it goes to other places. So the Solomon Islands is one of these places.
So I guess if consumption is increasing at this rate, what does that mean for places like the Solomon Islands?
Well, it means that if Australia doesn't also regulate the export, then they will continue to receive clothing that very often is not a good quality. So we have seen clothing with holes, clothing with stains. Some of the women we talked about textiles that basically comes apart, so they throw it away straight away. So my question is also an ethical one to Australians. Why would you donate clothing that we would not wear? Why would these people be wearing this kind of clothing? It's a really important question, and we hope that our film, we will be able to raise some awareness around this problem.
And that's Tiziana Ferreiro-Georges, Associate Professor of Fashion and Design at the Faculty of Creative Industries and Social Justice at the Queensland University of Technology. Literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but listen in this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it is your news, and coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua whaatu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.